welcome everybody to iloverealestate.tv. Great to have you guys on board and listening again. Now, don't forget to jump on the website and have a look at all my recent posts and have a look at all the stuff that I've been putting up there over the last few weeks. So jump on and catch up on all the webinars. You can also go to iTunes and download from there. Okay, guys. Now, what I thought might be appropriate, since we've gone through the whole budget thing and where that's heading, is to really look at where our opportunities are in the next 12 months, where things are heading. And the biggest part of an opportunity and being able to get into the market and make things happen, of course, is the money. Where am I getting the money from? How can I get the money? What's my capacity? How can I borrow money? Where are the banks doing? You know, I hear this and I hear that. And how come the banks aren't passing on what the Reserve Bank cuts and all of that kind of stuff? So I thought, what better to do than to actually talk about all of those things with my very good mate, who I have known for, it seems like forever, must be at least 16 or 17 years, Mr. Scott Nicholas from Investor Loans Network. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Dimna. How are you going today?
I'm doing fabulously. Now, talk to me. What's the market doing? What are we up to? Where do you see the general finance market heading in the next, say, 12 months?
Okay, we've just had a 0.5% drop from the Reserve Bank, which most banks have put on around 0.3% deduction from the variable interest rate. The word is after the recent budget that they are looking probably between another 0.5% to 0.75% drop through the Reserve Bank. So with any luck, we might end up with a 0.4 or 0.5% reduction, which will take our standard variable interest rates, or our PROPAC interest rates, I should say, down to around 5.5%. So that's pretty cheap money.
What do you mean by PROPAC? You can't use all this jargon around me. You know that. I'm going to make you explain it. What's PROPAC?
Well, professional PAC. So usually when you're borrowing in excess of $250,000, you can get a reduction off the standard variable rate of around 0.7%. So it used to be available for professionals only, but now it's based on the amount you borrow, and $250,000 is usually a pretty good guide.
Fair enough. So, with interest rates dropping, my take on that is that it will give some bit of a lift to the property market, and it's time to get in. You'll start to get some movement. I mean, there's some fabulous buys around at the moment with, any amount of positive cash flow properties you can poke a stick at, as well as, some areas when you really know the dynamics of microeconomics that's happening around Australia, you can start to see some areas that, honestly, if they don't go up by 30 to 40%, I'll be eating my hat. Fortunately, I don't wear a hat. But, all the signs are there for fabulous growth as well as passive income. So, we've got good times ahead of us for those who are educated and get out there and want to get into the market. And I think the biggest obstacle for those who are educated over the last couple of years has been financing, how to get money.
Oh, the finance market has had a couple of things going against it. The global financial crisis put a lot of dampener and slowdown on the monetary fund. That is now easing. We're seeing a lot of second-tier banks coming back into the market. We're seeing a lot of pressure on the big banks with new products from the second-tier guys, and the ability to lend. There was a little time there where nobody was wanting to lend any money. Now we're getting a lot of people coming back into the market and are very, very keen to get in and lend as much as they can. So it makes it very interesting and very accessible to anybody entering the market or wanting to borrow for investment.
I've noticed over the last, graduating over the last 12 months, how the LVRs, or the loan to valuation ratios, have actually crept up a little bit now. And, for somebody going in with a good income, they can basically borrow up to 95%, can't they?
Yeah, back to 95% with most banks, which is pretty much the maximum of where I like to see it. And then you can capitalise your mortgage insurance on top of that. So you need very little to be able to get into your first property right now.
How much is mortgage insurance?
It depends on the amount you borrow. It's structured between, I think it's above $250,000, there's a rate, and then above $500,000, there's another rate. So anywhere between 1.5% and 2% of the amount you borrow.
Okay. But, of course, that's just kind of like a cost of doing business. It gets added to the loan. You pay that off as part of the loan. It doesn't really hurt.
It just adds to the loan, as you say.
Yeah. So, you know, if that meant in that you could get into a property because you didn't have a whole lot of savings and get in there and do something to that property and increase the value of the property. I mean, one of the podcasts I did recently was actually on renovations. Even that is a simple little strategy. Make the property worth more. And, you know, that's if it's your own home, it's tax-free income. And even if it's not, my God, you've made money. Let's pay tax. I mean, what a novel thing to think that I want to get out there and pay tax.
Yeah, it seems to be everybody's fear paying tax. But, you know, really, the only right way you pay tax is when you make money. And making money is always a good thing.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's lots of ways we can minimise the tax once we've made it. Stop stressing about paying tax and you haven't even made it yet. So, as we said, you know, things are getting a little bit better. LVRs are coming up. Loan-to-valuation ratios are coming up. You mentioned something there about second-tier lenders coming into the market. What's a second-tier lender?
Well, basically we have our big four in Australia and they own a lot of the secondary lenders. But you see, there's a company called First Mac that's a private, now using private funders. They're now sponsoring the Broncos at the moment.
Are they really?
As a sleeve sponsor. Now Macquarie's coming back into the market. And some more overseas funds are coming through channels. So they're the ones that put the pressure on the big guys. You know, they're the ones that take market share and really stimulate the economy and make the big guys sit up and listen or look to see what's happening and even change a policy now and then.
And what about the ones that we hear about that seem to have names like insurance companies like ING and Rabo and this kind of stuff? Where do they fit into the whole hierarchy?
Yeah, they've always been around. They do a lot of specialist lending. Even HSBC are back in the market. So, you know, all of these little ones, these offshore banks entering our market with since the deregulation, they obviously see it's viable here to operate now.
Safe.
The market's freeing up, so it's a good place, a good safe place to lend money. So that really helps stimulate. As I said, if there's no pressure on the big four, they would hardly lend anything at all.
Well, they're still got to make money, I suppose.
They're still got to make money, but it'd be very restrictive on how they do it.
Yeah, certainly they'd only lend to the prime borrowers, let's say.
The gold bricks, as we term them in the industry.
Gold bricks.
Yes, the gold bricks.
Fair enough. And, yeah, it's a good thing to have pressure on them because a monopoly in that department isn't particularly good. I mean, regulation's okay, but monopoly's not. So, okay, we're starting to see that free up. We're starting to see some international banks come into the market. I mean, one of the things that I absolutely applaud and support as, you know, with you, Scott, I mean, we've been in business together and friends and invested together for many, many years. And, you know, you're the head of Investor Loans Network, which is a specialist broking firm, I suppose, is what the best way to describe it, where you provide a full service package and really, really look at everybody's individual circumstances and work out not only, you know, which loan can I get a loan, which is the normal stuff that the brokers tend to do, but also, okay, what's the best move for me next? What should I be doing after that? If I do this, how does it affect my next deal and all of those sort of things? Because, I mean, you primarily specialise with investors.
I very much deal with investors. We can deal with mum and dads, but investors is where we've really carved our niche. Really want to be there to assist the investors in their decision-making process because it can be pretty lonely out there when you start, you know, out on this track on your own. So we're there to assist in helping with a path to go and what sort of property do they need to buy, you know, what sort of money are they looking at spending at this property, and even when they find something they can bring it back to us and we can discuss the options and how it's going to affect their portfolio and their borrowing options moving forward.
Okay, and this is one of the reasons that you know, I like to use people like yourself is because with a, you know, you go to a bank. Now, let's say you go to one of the big four banks. Obviously, they're only going to sell you their stuff and they're going to say that they're the best. And they may say you can get a loan or you can't get a loan. And that may or may not necessarily be true. Obviously, it's true for that bank, but it doesn't mean that if you get a no from them, doesn't mean you can't take it to somebody else.
That's right. They're dealing with one set of policies, one set of products. So, and you know, depending on the bank's attitude to the market at the time can very much determine what their policy situation is. So,
and that can change from week to week.
Very much so.
So how's the average guy out there expected to know?
Well, they're not. No, we get bulletins and updates all the time saying, you know, which banks are moving in the market. You know, one will be lowering interest rates in a fixed rate. One will be more aggressive out there, you know, really promoting business, giving no application fee deals, and really doing some sweeteners out there because they're chasing money because they want to build up their loan book. Mm. So, you know, brokers are in touch with that all the time, whereas somebody out on the street would spend a lot of foot miles running around trying to find out the same information.
That's exactly right. And you know, just even one person's circumstance, there might be five or six different lenders that will fit the bill. But depending on what your deal is after this deal will depend on which one you take, because, you know, it might be a short-term deal. So we want one without exit fees. It might be a one where you're going to go back and refinance, and some banks are better for refinance than other banks. And there's all of that peripheral information which you need to know so much more than, can I get a loan?
That's correct. Even looking at this deal now and looking forward to what deals you want to do, you really need to know which banks to place the normal or regular deals with, because down the track you might be looking to do something a little bit different and you want a specialist bank and you don't want to, you know, burn that one on the way through.
One of the things that that I've come across over the time I've been an accountant and all of that kind of stuff is quite often people come with a mark on their credit history of some description. And, you know, it might be a bad mark, like a bankruptcy or a past bankruptcy or a part 10 or something like that, or it might be just something, a minor indiscretion. Now, you know, a mark on your credit rating can affect your ability to be able to borrow with some banks, or at least at what interest rates you're able to borrow. So you actually work with people in that regard as well to with some other organisations to clear their credit in some cases.
Yeah, if the mark is bad enough and the bank, it's going to be an obstacle when lending, yeah, we can look at referring you to companies that specialise in clearing your credit reports.
And what's the cost of that sort of thing?
Some charge up between $1,500 and $2,000, depending on the amount of default or judgment or whatever it is. So, you know, it really is a case-by-case basis, but between $1,500 and $2,000.
And that's well worth it if it means you can get into a loan and get in there and make some money as opposed to not being able to.
Or you used the term cost of doing business earlier. You know, if you've got something like that and it's going to stop you doing a deal, being able to do the deal and make money, the $2,000 can be a very cheap price to pay.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, if somebody's got a bit of a mark on their credit rating, depending on how severe it is, there are lenders that will, you know, lend to people that have marks on their credit rating, just at higher interest rate. Is that basically how it works?
Usually higher interest rate and at times a lower LVR.
So instead of being able to borrow like 80%, they might only be able to borrow, say, 60% or something like that.
60 or 70%. Depends on how long ago it was and how bad the issue was.
Okay. So, and that, again, that's where you need to sit down with yourself and, you know, you've got representatives all around Australia, and they, you know, for anyone who's listening, you can just jump on the website www.investorloansnetwork.com.au.
Correct.
And see where the closest branch is for you, and sit down and go through all of these things. Now, obviously, a lot of these third-tier lenders, and when you're borrowing larger amounts of money, as in not large amounts of money, but larger LVRs, like your 90% and your 95%, you've got to pay mortgage insurance. Now, we've talked about the cost of mortgage insurance. You know, is that something where you can just shop around and get different mortgage insurance? What's the market for mortgage insurance in Australia?
Now, each bank will use their an allocated mortgage insurer. There are actually only two mortgage insurance companies in Australia at the moment, and some banks choose to self-insure. So each mortgage insurance company will have their own rules, regulations, policies, and debt exposure limits that you need to be able to comply to, but you never get to speak to the mortgage insurers. This is all done by the bank and the relationship through the bank.
Okay, now both of those mortgage insurers are both American-owned, aren't they?
Correct.
So through the GFC, they were making a lot of decisions based on what was happening in America rather than what was happening here, because they were hurting like crazy with all the foreclosures coming out of the States.
Yeah, their policies definitely run out of the USA, and yes, they got very, very restrictive and very tight during the peak of the downturn, and they're just very, very slowly starting to ease back now. It's like any insurance company, you know, when they've been hurt badly, they're very, very slow to expose themselves to any risk for a little while.
Even though in Australia, through the GFC, our foreclosures, I mean, you know, we get the big headline in the newspaper saying that our foreclosure rate has gone up by 50%. But we started at 0.4, so that means it went to 0.6, which is actually not very much at all.
No, I never really did get, no, it's a shame for anyone to lose their home, but relatively, Australia did very, very well through the whole GFC.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another thing that is quite advantageous to, you know, to be using, you know, someone like yourself and rather than going directly to the banks, is that, you know, you might go to one bank and they say yes or no, but, you know, here are the conditions, and you go to another bank and they do the same, then you go to another bank. That's called shopping your loan. And that's actually really, really bad for your ability to be able to borrow money both then and in the future, isn't it?
That's correct, because as soon as you present your information to a bank and even just sign an expression of interest, they're going to be doing a credit check on you.
And what's that?
Credit check just basically tells them what inquiries you've had for the amounts, the dates that you inquired, as well as if you've been in any trouble, any judgments, defaults, and any arrears you might have had with a telecommunications company or a credit card company. If they've had a problem with you, they can lodge a default on there, and right up to your bankruptcies in Part 10. So what banks will look at here is if you're shopping around, it doesn't say why you are shopping around. So if you've gone to two or three places in recent times and looked for an amount, say, of $250,000, the next bank will wonder why.
Because they'll see, well, you must have applied with this bank and you applied with that bank and you applied with the next bank. They all said no, so why should I say yes?
Yeah, why haven't you got it by now? And what have you told them that you're not telling me?
Uh-huh.
So are you educating yourself on the way around? Because banks will always look at the worst-case scenario.
Yeah, and that's the safety net, I suppose.
Oh, that's the safe way of doing it.
Okay. So it looks like, you know, everybody else has said no, even if you've just gone around and asked some inquiries. As soon as you sign a piece of paper with a bank, that generally means that they can actually lodge it on your credit report.
They will do. That's
how they work.
That's how it works.
So a credit report, what is it in Australia? Because, you know, we hear all this stuff about America and the movies and all this kind of stuff where you've got to get your credit up and you should go and get lots of credit cards and have, use them all the time and all that kind of thing so that you can get your credit score up. But that's all American hogwash, isn't it? That doesn't apply to Australia.
No, it doesn't apply to Australia. Very American. All it is in Australia is when you pull a report, it will show the date that you applied for, whether it be a credit card, a personal loan, like shop finance, or a bank or a mortgage. It will show the date, the institution that you applied through, and the amount. It doesn't say whether it was approved, taken, refused. That is all the information that is on there.
Okay. So when you start looking at these reports, they've started this scoring system in Australia, but in America, this is how it works. In America, you have a credit score. Now, it's called a FICO score. There's three credit things over there, three credit companies. One's the Beacon, one's Empirica, and one's FICO. And basically, for every bill that you pay on time or every loan payment that you pay on time, it all goes into this massive computer system, regardless of whether it's the, your electricity bill, your phone bill, or an account with the local general store. You pay them on time, your credit score goes up. You pay them late, your credit score goes down. You have any defaults, obviously your credit score plummets. And the higher your credit score, the more money they'll lend you, the lower interest rate, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an actual score that you can look up on any one of these credit references associations and find out what your score is. That's not the case in Australia. We don't have this massive big brother computer system monitoring every bill that we pay and whether we pay it on time or not. We don't have any of the restrictions that America has on their financing system over there with bill paying. It's never going to be that in Australia. Even though they've implemented this scoring system, nobody seems to even know how it works.
No, there is a scoring system that's now appearing on top of these credit reports. But as you say, I've talked to a lot of people in the mortgage business, in the banking business, and no one has yet to be able to tell me what it's there for or how it's going to be implemented in the future. So it's just sitting there.
Watch this space.
Watch this space, yes.
One of the other great things that I love about dealing with Investor Loans Network and, you know, the ability to be able to shop the banks without shopping the banks per se is to have a little bit more flexibility and freedom when it comes to valuations. Because if you get a valuation on your property and say it doesn't come up to the value that you want it to come up to, whether it be a refinance or whether it actually be a you know, for a new loan, once that valuation has been aired and the banks have seen it, well, that's the one they're going to go and use. Whereas you actually have the ability to be able to order a valuation, and if it isn't quite what you would like, you might be able to get another one.
Yeah, it's a wonderful new innovation that's come in. We can do the upfront valuations and present them with the deals. So as you just said, that we can order a valuation on a property. If it's not quite where we think it should be and where our customer thinks it should be, we can approach another valuating firm to get them to do the job, and we can present the one that we choose to the bank for our purposes. If the two of them together, well, that might be where the property is in the market, but if there's a large difference, we'll present the one that best assists the client in what they need to do.
Yeah. And that, honestly, that makes a massive difference to your ability to be able to move forward quickly with your property investing. Because if you're stuck on a property because it hasn't valued up, or you're not able to buy a property because you had a bad valuation because the valuer was having a bad day that day, that might hold you back for months or even years before you can get on with income replacement and all the great strategies that we talk about.
We've all seen deals where there could be, you know, up to $100,000 difference between two valuations on the same property within 24 hours. So there is no hard and fast rule to valuing a property. So if you don't like the first one, you can always ask for another.
I remember you talking to me a number of years ago about one of your clients that had a unit in Sydney, and they got a valuation that wasn't particularly wonderful. Just explain what you did with that client.
Okay. What we did there is they actually had some university students that were renting the apartment, and that reflected in the first valuation. So
As in the furniture wasn't real good.
Yeah, well,
and dirty.
They had beer boxes and Papa Sans.
Pizza boxes all over the kitchen.
Yeah, so when the valuer came through, it wasn't shown in its best light. So what our clients in discussion with us decided to do was send them away on a weekend. They paid for their accommodation, bought them a box of beer and got some movie tickets so they were entertained for the weekend. While they were out, they actually moved the Papa Sans and beer boxes, had a good clean up, and actually bought in some staged furniture. Uh-huh. Because there was a new valuation to be done on the Monday.
So they did all of this over the weekend?
Over the weekend this was done. So on the Monday, when a new valuer came was to come through that had never seen the property before, he valued the property $130,000 more than...
getting rid of the beer boxes.
Again, it's just how it was presented. You know, it smelt better, it looked better, it felt better. So he had a better feeling about the whole thing. Because you've got to remember that valuers will value as they see the property.
Yeah.
So if it smells ugly, looks ugly, it'll value ugly.
I remember also you talking about another one of your clients. It reminds me of a story where they were looking for a refinance on their property so that they could renovate the property, increase the value of the property and go off and invest. But what happened between the time they spoke to you and when the valuer came in?
They took all the plaster off the walls.
Oh, that's a great thing to do.
Yeah, very efficient. So when the plaster came through, there was no plaster on some of the walls. So consequently, the valuation was shocking. I think a mate was doing the plastering, so we got the mate in and got it all plastered and painted and back again, and we actually got the same valuer through about a week later, and he gave it the valuation that we required now that everything was put back together. But as he said to me when I questioned him, he said, I walked in, there wasn't any walls. I've got to value it when it hasn't got any walls.
And that would have made a massive difference to the value of the property.
Oh, the first one wasn't even worth looking at.
Okay. Well, next thing I want to talk about, Scott, is something that is my pet hate. And all the banks do it, and all the banks will try it on. Unless you know what to do about it, you can get wrapped up in ropes and tights and things so that you can't actually even get out of it, or not at least not very easily. And that is cross-securitization. Banks will inevitably try and get all of your business. You know, they want all of your borrowing, they want all of the houses that you've got, and they want it all with that particular bank. But I disagree with that absolutely, positively, totally, because what that means is if anything goes wrong, if there's a downturn or you simply don't fit in the box of that particular lending agent anymore, they can foreclose on the property. They can give you like 30 days or 60 days notice and say, sorry, you've got to take your mortgage somewhere else without any reason. They've just got all of that power in their mortgage documents.
That's exactly right. You know, banks want to control you. You know, in my history when I was in the banks, you know, we wanted to get at least, I think it was 4.2 products per customer, because when we had that, the banks would tell us that it was too hard for the client to leave and go anywhere else. They would just stay put. So for that, to that effect, now banks want to buy your business. So if you've got a multiple property portfolio and insurance products, they will give you large discounts.
To keep you.
To attract all of your business or to keep you. But at the end of the day, the bank is controlling the process. As Dimna was saying before, if they have a policy change or you want to move forward and it's not in the bank's interest, they can just say no. And at that time, it is very, very hard for you to start untangling what has been set up. And it's very, very time-consuming. It might not be that costly, but it can be very time-consuming trying to sort it out and do a partial release of security and start the wheels moving forward again.
Mm. And sometimes you just get trapped, and you can be trapped for 2 or 3 years while, you know, the properties grow in value or whatever else before you can actually start investing again. And it's crippling.
It's one thing that we've seen a lot during the last few years, which haven't been the best for real estate, we all know that, is people have sold properties off when they've had cross-securitised situations and they're expecting a payment out of the sale of the profit, and the banks have actually chosen to retain those funds.
And they can.
And they can. It says it in the mortgage document. So they retain those funds and pay it off the mortgage just to make their position better and reduce your LVR.
Nice. Actually, it goes further than that too, because basically if you no longer fit in the bank box, let's say something happens, and in the mortgage clauses the mortgage documents that you sign, there are clauses in there like the all monies clause. Now, the all monies clause basically says that if your circumstances change, the all monies clause says that they can take security over any property that they have security over, they can foreclose on to fund any debt, basically. So if you've got all your properties with the one banking institution, then they can foreclose on any property. And the obvious thing is, which one are they going to take first? It's always going to be your house, because it's one of it's normally the most expensive property, it's normally the best property, and it's normally the one that's the first to sell, easiest to sell. It's
always the best presented property.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing that is in your mortgage documents, which a lot of people don't realise, is that when circumstances change, such as, you might go from employed to self-employed, that you're supposed to go and tell the bank that your circumstances have changed, or you might go from employed to unemployed, or, change jobs, or go part-time, or have a baby, or, you know, any of those circumstances, your circumstances have changed. You're supposed to go to the bank and say, oh, look, my circumstances have changed. I'm going to take 2 years off and have children. Our income for the family is now halved, or I've lost my job, or whatever else. What do you think the bank's going to do?
I think the bank will pull your file and have a review about that time.
You get chosen for a random audit.
Could be on to the random audit pile, yes.
So what can a bank do when something like that happens?
Well, as I said, they mightn't do anything straight away, but they'll be watching you very closely and how things are moving from there. So they can't really act until you default, especially in the personal market. So residential lending, residential investment lending all comes under the code, and they can't jump on you or start any default action until you actually default. You can even ask for, you know, times of clemency if you come on hard times, and the banks have got to be fair and reasonable in their dealings. But what you really don't want to be is highlighted to the banks at all. You want to be anonymous and, you know, buried down the bottom of the pile and never to really surface.
Now, obviously, for business owners and things like that, where they've got their bank accounts with the same bank that they have their loans with, that can be a little bit dangerous too, because, I mean, the banks have a monitoring system on the account activity and can determine, you know, if your turnover goes down. Say you own a coffee shop and, you know, you're trading along okay, but times are a bit hard and your turnover starts to go down. They'll know about it before you do, practically, and then start to put you on that random audit pile again.
Well, they will.
Not so random.
Not so random. That's exactly right, because, you know, they have things in place to make sure, again, the banks will want to make sure they're covered. And if you're dealing with a business banking area, they sometimes will want to do not even random audits. They want to do a 12-month review of your trading statements and how you've been going.
And if you're doing things like, you know, in construction, say you're developing or you're in business and you're buying commercial property and things like that, they can actually pull the loan for really no reason at all.
At their discretion.
Isn't that horrific? I mean, you can be in the middle of a project and then bingo, the whole thing's taken away because, you know, because you no longer fit in their policy box.
Oh, there's been many occasions where banks sort of say, you go and do this, this and this and we'll give you the money. But in the meantime, they've had a change of heart and then they just don't do it anyway. So you could have spent tens of thousands of dollars doing what the bank asked you to do, but then they go, sorry, no.
You have a bit of a rule about that, don't you? Something about he who has the money?
He who has the money makes the rules.
Just tell everybody about that mate of yours who owned the childcare centre and what happened with that.
It's a very tragic story. It's basically, again, it's a classic cross-securitisation story. He had a nice house which he owned outright, worth just in excess of $1 million, bought a childcare centre, freehold and the business. He'd run it for a few years and it was, you know, was reasonably good, worked well. In the wisdom, the council approved two more childcare centres in the vicinity of where this one was positioned, so he knew things were going to get a little bit tight for a while. So he approached the bank that he was with, against my advice. He went to the bank and told them that things were going to be tight for a little while and they wanted him to carry him. He was a commercial loan. So it didn't work out the way he wanted them to, because he didn't know at the time, but the bank that he was dealing with was having a few financial issues of their own and they were really struggling to keep afloat. So instead of assisting him and lending him a helping hand like he was hoping for, they actually started action on him straight away. So he really was under duress to sell the childcare centre, and in the end he had the childcare centre and his home on the market at the same time. This was during the last few years when things were very, very tight. All the while he was accruing default fees, legal fees, because the bank was getting nastier and nastier. He ended up getting a contract on his childcare centre for about $800,000, which was about $500,000 less than what he'd bought it for a few years before. And the story doesn't end there, because during the contract process, the new purchaser got wind that he was in a duress situation, withdrew the original contract and offered him $600,000.
Gosh.
So he
ended up... What did he pay for it?
1.2.
Half. Mm-hmm.
So what he ended up having to do is he ended up selling that, and the very sad part of the story is that, as he predicted, at the same time the settlement was happening, the childcare centre was starting to operate profitably yet again. So the 6-month duration that it took, you know, of all the heartache and pain that he went through with the bank and the childcare centre, if they just would have been able to back him through that time, he would have come out and still been able to trade. In the end, he ended up having to sell the childcare centre and his house, and he walked out of there with less than $300,000.
And he was worth over $1 million.
He was worth over $1 million before he started.
Gee. Bad news. I mean, and this is where, you know, we can get very complacent with this sort of thing and not, well, I guess ignorance is bliss in a lot of instances, but I tell you what, it's not when something happens. But if you want to get out there and start treating this, you know, in property investing as a business and start to replace income and those sort of things, you've got to know this stuff. And there's a lot more. I mean, we could never cover what needs to be known in, you know, the space of a podcast. But at least if people get an understanding of the fact that they need to step up from general, I'm buying a house to live in and that's it, with one house, to multiple properties, having different banks for different investments, you know, using the banking products to your advantage, not one size fits all when it comes to financial products, and really knowing, you know, all of these little idiosyncrasies about what action can be taken in what regard, particularly when you start replacing income and investing in a number of different properties.
Oh, very much so. Look, banks have so many different rules and policies. You know, we were looking at just a very, very standard situation the other day with a couple with a combined income of around $120,000. Mm-hmm. And now we look at a span of over 30-odd banks that we can deal with, and we're looking at a maximum borrowing amount that varied between around $420,000 up to $900,000 with the exact same criteria, and that was just on two wages. That wasn't taking into account different policies on rents, childcare, family allowance, depreciation, or anything that may be a little bit tricky. That was just a very, very simple scenario of two incomes.
And, you know, as you said there, other things affect it. Like if I've got a swag of credit cards, even if they've got zero balances, that affects how much money I can borrow.
Well, even if you pay it off, some banks will still want that limit to be taken into account, whereas some banks will waive it if you can show 3 months or 6 months of payment history. So
how much would a $10,000 credit card affect my borrowing capacity on average?
About $30,000.
Okay, so for every credit card I've got, even if the balance is zero, for every $10,000 credit card I've got, that's basically $30,000 less that I can borrow to go and buy an investment property, even if it's positive cash flow.
Correct.
Huh. What about kids?
Kids are a funny thing. Again, banks have
different... You're not kidding. I've got three of them.
They cost you, on average, you know, they did have different rules, but around $50,000 per child.
It's cheaper to have a credit card.
It is cheaper to have a credit card and a holiday. So each child that you have will restrict your borrowing by $50,000.
Okay, so I've just got a child turned 18. Can I get rid of him off my dependents list?
He's still dependent, isn't he?
Depends which way you look at it. Should he be dependent on my application?
Well, what I'd suggest there is you might remove him off your Medicare card.
Okay.
And give him his own Medicare card because he is 18, he is of age.
Uh-huh. That's a good trick.
I'll give that one away for nothing.
You didn't tell me that one. So if he's 18, he can go and get his own Medicare card. Therefore, he doesn't appear on mine. Therefore, he's not a dependent as far as I'm concerned for lending purposes.
Correct.
Which means I can borrow $50,000 more.
Yes.
All these little pearls of wisdom you come up with. Okay, so just to finish up, banking industry's getting better?
Definitely getting better. Like 12 months ago, I'd say it's sort of bouncing along, just eking its way up. Now I can see a distinct trend in wanting to lend money, very keen in the market, getting a lot of phone calls from lending managers and BDM saying that they're really keen to start lending. Interest rates are going in the right direction. I think it's all looking good. Look, it's still not easy, but it's all looking good and getting better.
Timeframes, are they coming in? Because during the GFC we saw application times on properties really getting out there. They're sometimes even up to 12 weeks.
No, they're not that bad. But what we're finding now is, especially that we had, I'm not going to name it, but one little lender the other day forecast that they weren't going to drop their interest rate, their fixed rates for a month. They got absolutely inundated with applications.
Hang on. They weren't going to drop their interest rates for a month.
Sorry, they were going to hold their fixed rate.
Okay, for a month.
For a month.
Okay, so their fixed rate was held, which means you could still get a cheaper interest rate, presumably, for the month.
Correct. Okay. So Therefore, they were chasing business. They were putting something really cheap out into the marketplace. They got absolutely smashed with applications.
Yep.
And they got out to 6 or 8 weeks approvals. Because they don't put the back office in. The sales department doesn't talk to the workers. So occasions like that can still happen, but generally you're looking at a couple of weeks for an approval, unconditional approval.
Okay. Now, of course, we can borrow in superannuation funds too now.
We can.
And that's pretty exciting.
It's still a lot longer process. I'd be looking at your 10 or 12 weeks to do that because there's a lot more involved in borrowing your super fund, but we can, and we're looking up to around 70 and 80% depending on the return on the property.
Okay, so in your superannuation fund, we've talked about this before with Ian about setting up the right structures, etc., but you've got to put it into a bear trust. But with LVRs of 70 and 80%, that really opens the door through a self-managed superannuation fund for a whole nother way of investing for long term.
Oh, very much so. It is heavily dependent on the return of the property, but that is where we're heading.
Okay. So good times ahead.
Very much so.
I know you haven't got a crystal ball, but with the interest rates coming down somewhere between 0.5% to 3/4% over the next 12 months, say up to Christmas, with that stimulating the property market and, you know, the turnover, a few more people who've been sitting on the fence going, oh, I want to sell or I want to buy, but no, not yet, it's too uncertain, I don't know what's happening. They'll all start to get a little bit more confidence, get back into the market again, a bit more turnover, a bit more fluidness in the property market itself, particularly in the majors, major cities, I mean. And then with the second tier and third tier lenders coming in from overseas and creating a bit more competition and pressure on the bigger banks, I mean, towards the end of this year and into next year is looking pretty rosy.
I think the real estate market is really going to start moving again,
yeah,
solidly.
Yeah.
Because we're just going to have that many more borrowers able to get back into the marketplace, whereas mm-hmm. for the last couple of years they've been excluded.
Mm-hmm.
So more people looking to buy houses, more pressure.
And also because borrowing for development has been so tough over the last 3-4 years, what that means is that there hasn't been a lot of stock come out of the ground. So it's creating this shortage in supply. Demand's increasing. It's already oversupply now, and it's going to get worse because of the exchange rate going down and more activity and all those sort of things, and the pent up demand that we've had. A lot of people have been living at home and not going out and buying a property because, you know, all those factors, uncertainty in the market, interest rates, all that sort of stuff. That's all pent up demand that'll go blop onto the market very soon, and you know, and then we've got the pressure from the overseas banks putting pressure on the big boys, more money getting out there. You know, some of these markets, particularly like Sydney as an example, it's had massive undersupply problems, and then now it's even worse because not very much has been coming out of the ground. It could well, when it hits, it could hit really hard and really fast.
It could. We really don't want it to hit too hard because we don't like peaks and troughs. We like a little
controlled growth would be
wonderful. It keeps everybody happy that way. But you know, there is going to be some real pressure points around the country that are going to spring up.
I mean, a lot of the activity in the that's caused by the mining sector is already under a pressure cooker sort of scenario right now. But the majors are going to feel it, particularly those that are so dramatically undersupplied, like places like Sydney.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, so it's good times ahead.
Wonderful.
Okay, Scott. Well, as I said before, if you want to get in touch with any of the boys from Investor Loans Network, boys and girls, from Investor Loans Network anywhere around the country, they've got offices right around the country, all you need to do is to go to the website, www.investorloansnetwork.com.au, and see where your closest branch is. Their details are there. Their phone numbers are there. Jump on the phone and give one of the boys or girls a chat.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks, Scott, for coming on and sharing your wisdom with all of us on www.iloverealestate.tv. No dot in the beginning. www.iloverealestate.tv. So thank you, guys. Jump on iTunes, download the podcast, jump on the website, and I will be back again to talk to you very, very soon about something completely different. So bye for now.